And a problem is a question to which no one yet knows an answer. How well we know that significance. Geschert stood away from the wall, and the Kratzer turned to face the servant, by which acts Dietrich knew that it had been the servant who had last spoken, and that the servant had spoken out of turn. Whether Geschert or the Kratzer cried, "Silence!" was unclear, but the servant was unfazed. You could ask him. With that, the Herr Geschert sprang across the room. The leap was lightning quick, vaulting the furniture, and before Dietrich had quite grasped what had happened, the Lord was beating the servant of the talking head with his rasping forearms, raising cuts and welts with each blow. The Kratzer, too, had turned his anger on the servant and pummeled him with kicks. Dietrich sat speechless for a moment before, without thinking, he cried, "Stop!" and interposed himself between the combatants. The first blow to the side of his head was enough to render him insensible, so he never felt the others. When he came again to his senses, he found himself still in the same apartment, lying as he had fallen. Of Geschert and the Kratzer there was no sign. However, the servant sat on the floor beside him, with his great long legs drawn up. Where a man might have rested his chin upon his knees, these knees actually topped his head. The servant's skin was already discoloring with the dark green bruising of his folk. When Dietrich stirred, the servant chattered something, and the box on the desk spoke. "Why took you the blows on yourself?" Dietrich shook his head to rid it of the ringing, but the sensation in his ears did not go away. He placed a hand on his brow. "That was not my purpose. I thought to stop them." "But why?" "They were beating you. I did not think that good." "Think." "When we speak sentences inside our heads that no one can hear."
"And good?"
"It does me sorrow, friend Grasshopper, but there is too much noise inside my head to answer so subtle a question." Dietrich struggled to his feet. The servant made no move to help him.
"Our cart is broken," the servant said.
Dietrich tried his shoulder and winced. "What?"
"Our cart is broken, and its hare is dead. And we must stay here and die and never see our homeland again. The steward of the cart who rules now said that to reveal this would show our weakness and so invite an attack."
"The hare would not..."
"We hear the words you speak," the crank said. "We see the things you do, and all the words for these things the Heinzelmanken has mastered. But the words for what is here..." And the creature laid a gracile, six-fingered hand across his stomach. "These words we do not have. Perhaps we can never have them. For you are so very strange."
7. September 1348. The Apparition of Our Lady of Ransom. Some in the village, when they saw the bruises that their priest had endured at the hands of those he had sought to help, wished to drive the lepers from the great woods. But Herr Manfred von Hochwald declared that none might trespass there save by his grace. He stood a squad of armsmen on the Bear Valley Road to turn back any who, from curiosity or revenge, sought the Lazaretto. In the following days, Schweitzer's men turned back Oliver, the baker's son, with several other young men of the village, Theresia Gresch and her basket of herbs, and, to Dietrich's astonishment, Frau Joachim of Herbolzheim. The motives of young Oliver and his friends were easily known. The deeds of knights were their bread and ale. Oliver grew his hair to shoulder length to ape his betters, and wore his knife tucked sword-like into his belt. The love of a good fight quickened them, and revenge for their pastor provided but a finer-sounding reason for fist and cudgel. Dietrich gave them a tongue-lashing and told them that if he could forgive those who struck him, they could do likewise. The motives that drove Theresia toward the great wood were at once more transparent and more opaque.
for in her herb basket she had placed, with the rue and the yarrow and the pot marigold, certain obnoxious mushrooms and the keen knife that she sometimes used to let blood. Dietrich questioned her on these items when Schweitzer's men had returned her to the parsonage, and proper answers could indeed be found in Abbess Hildegard's Physica. Yet Dietrich wondered if she had had other employments in mind. The thought troubled him, but he could not logically ask her motives when he had not yet established her purpose. As for Joachim, the friar said only that poor and landless men needed God's word more than most. When Dietrich replied that the lepers needed succor more than sermons, Joachim laughed. When Max and Hilda went to the Lazaretto on St. Eustace Day, Dietrich pleaded that he was still too sore, and repaired instead to the refectory of his parsonage, where he ate an oat porridge that Theresia had cooked in the outbuilding. Theresia sat across the table from him, absorbed in her needlepoint. He had, beside the porridge, a breast of hazel hen that had been rubbed with sage and bread and a little wine and boiled. The hen was dry in spite of all, and every time he bit into it his mouth would hurt because his jaw was swollen and a tooth on that side had come loose.
"A tincture made of clove would help the tooth," Theresia said, "were clove not so dear."
"How well to hear of absent treatments," Dietrich muttered.
"Time must be the healer," she answered. "Until then, only porridges or soups."
"Yes, O Dr. Tortula."
Theresia shrugged off the sarcasm.
"My herbs and bone-setting are enough for me." "And your bloodletting," Dietrich reminded her.
She smiled. "Sometimes blood wants letting."
When Dietrich looked at her sharply, she added,
"It's a matter of balancing the humors."
Dietrich could not penetrate her sentence. Had she intended revenge on the Krenken, blood for blood?
"Beware the rage of the placid, for it smoulders long after more lively flames have died."
He took another bite of hazel hen and placed a hand against his jaw.
"The Krenken deal mighty blows."
"You must keep the poultice in place. It will help the bruising." "They are terrible people, these Krenken of yours, to treat you so, dear father."
The words tugged at his heart. "They are lost and afraid. Such men often lash out." Theresia attended her needlepoint.
"I think Brother Joachim is right. I think they need another sort of aid than that which you and the miller's wife have been bringing them."
"If I can forgive them, so can you."
"Have you, then, forgiven them?"
"But naturally." Theresia laid her needlepoint in her lap.
"It is not so natural to forgive. Revenge is natural. Strike a cur and it will snap. Stir up a wasp's nest and they will sting. That is why it took such a one as our blessed Lord to teach us to forgive. If you have forgiven these people, why have you not gone back, while the soldier and the miller's wife have?"
Dietrich laid the breast aside, half-eaten. Buridan had argued that there could be no action at a distance, and forgiveness was an action. Could there be forgiveness at a distance? A pretty question. How could he move the Krenken to depart if he did not go to them? But the Krenkish ferocity terrified him. "A few days more rest," he said, postponing the decision. "Come, bring the sweet cakes now by the fire, and I will read to you from De Usu Partium,"
his adopted daughter brightened. "I do so love to hear you read, especially the books of healing."
On the feast of Our Lady of Ransom, Dietrich limped to the fields to assess the ploughing on the tithe lands, which he farmed to Felix, Hervé Guanai, and others. The second planting had begun, and so the lowing of oxen and the neighing of horses, mixed with the jingle of harness and whippletree, the curses of the ploughmen, and the whapping of mattocks and clodding beetles. Hervig had broken the field in April and was ploughing more deeply now. Dietrich spoke briefly with the man and was content with his labors. He noticed Trude Metzger behind the plough on the neighboring man's. Her oldest son Melchior tugged the lead ox by a strap, while her younger son, a stripling, swung a mattock not much smaller than he was.
Hervig, turning his own team about on the headland, volunteered the wisdom that the plough was man's work.